We have collected local wisdom from village elders about water sources, watering holes, seasonal species.
We looked at instead of using plastic bags, we used paper bags for our food deliveries, and tried to figure out how to have the least amount of carbon impact by sending food in a certain systematic manner.
They come from different landscapes other than ours. We pull water, we pull air, we bring soil, we bring sand to build our cities. We bring all sorts of things from outside to give us a fairly man-made infrastructure which we think is climate-proof.
We worked very closely with the BMC during that time, and that has really helped us out and got us a lot of goodwill.
Hello and welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, and businesses, and professionals, and of course, philanthropists, who are disruptors, yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms. In these special episodes, Catalyzing Change, the Power of Family Philanthropy, as part of Unusual Suspects in collaboration with GivingPie, India's first family-focused philanthropy network, we will be talking about a rapidly evolving philanthropic landscape and the paradigm shift that is underway. Philanthropists are increasingly leveraging technology, engaging in collaborative efforts, exploring innovative financial models, and placing a strong emphasis on equity and inclusion in their giving strategies. Together with families and philanthropists, we'll explore diverse giving approaches and evolving perspectives, aiming to inspire a new era of impactful philanthropy, especially in critical
and underserved sectors.
In today's episode, we embark on an exploration of the need and potential for family philanthropy to channel investments into climate action. We underscore the interconnected nature of the climate crisis and delve into the pivotal role philanthropy can play in fortifying grassroots initiatives aimed at addressing this global challenge. I'm delighted to have Lina Dandekar, founder of Raintree Family Office and Raintree Foundation. Lina is committed to crafting sustainable, resilient, and thriving ecosystems and is currently focusing on the Velhe region in the Western Ghats, a critical area for climate resilience. I also have Pragya Kapoor, founder and CEO of Eksaath, the Earth Foundation. Her foundation works to create an environment free from ignorance and exploitation by developing an eco-friendly environment through plantation of trees in urban and rural areas, by eradicating plastic pollution that harms human, aquatic, and wildlife, and to maximize reforestation to protect the wildlife and bring people closer to nature. Welcome to Unusual Suspects, Lina and Pragya. Delighted to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Gaurav, for having us.
Thank you, Gaurav. Happy to be here.
Lina, first to you. Your work with the Raintree Foundation focuses on grassroots initiatives to combat climate change and its far-reaching impacts. And it's important and very interesting that we are having this conversation at a time when the air in Delhi and large parts of North India has turned, if I may say so, very toxic and very difficult to breathe. Could you take us on a journey through Raintree Foundation's unique landscape-based approach? How does your program empower communities to thrive while simultaneously preserving and regenerating natural systems? I ask you this question because everything that has to go with bringing about a change in our approach to protecting the planet has to involve the communities, which is us. How can we all be co-participants, and how is Raintree Foundation actually bringing this about? Lina?
Yes. Thank you, Gaurav, for having me here. Raintree Foundation works on climate resilience for living landscapes. And given what we do, the definition of where we work and what we do is embedded in the word living landscapes, right? We work on a landscape model, which uses, works on all aspects of prosperity, of development in a well-defined geography. Because we are an environmental focused foundation, our geography is always defined by natural boundaries, because that makes it a contiguous logical boundary for nature-based interventions. So from that angle, we chose Velhe some time back, 5 years ago to be precise, and we are in the process of choosing a new landscape for our next project starting next year. But what we do is map out all the aspects of the landscape, all the natural systems. So we have done biodiversity mapping, we have done aquifer mapping, we have done hydrogeological surveys, we have done land use, land cover mappings. We have collected local wisdom from village elders about water sources, watering holes, seasonal species, maybe seasonal vegetables, you know, and forest vegetables, those kind of things. And we have put that all together, and for we have given that data a voice. So because nature doesn't have a voice in most development models, Raintree interprets this data and gives nature the voice. But that isn't good enough. You cannot go to a landscape which is the home of people and multiple species of all kinds and tell them what to do from the outside. It is very important that communities, as in a sense, first among equals of all the species who are in that landscape and having the ability to protect it the most, need to understand the facts, the opportunities, the limitations of that landscape and use it to their advantage for their own prosperity in a manner in which nature can regenerate. So our job doesn't stop at giving nature a voice. That voice needs to become the voice of the community, speaking for nature. And from that angle, we use the Biodiversity Management Act and have created biodiversity management committees, are in the process of making people's biodiversity registers, which empowers the communities to have a large amount of control over the biodiversity mapped in their own area. And it also creates a formal forum under our Indian systems to take this forward once we exit, because you know these can't be 10-year, 15-year plans. These perceptions and attitudes about definitions of prosperity need to be embedded in the community and need to go into the community generation after generation. So that's the piece of nature. We are working on models from this data called watershed ecology, which is essentially reviving all the natural water systems in that given valley. It includes spring shed management, river rejuvenation, desilting, repairing, enhancing wells, recharge mechanisms, protection of microhabitats, soil erosion controls. And what it ensures is that there is water available, not just for the community, but for the ecosystem at large. Because where there is water, you will have biodiversity in abundance. That's on the natural aspects and how we participate with the community in enhancing and preserving and pass on the custodianship of these natural landscapes and systems to the community. Coming to the community-based work, there has to be a reason for the community to buy into the climate agenda. And because our development model over the years has so become so human-centric with no regard for nature, there is a mind shift change to be made, not just in households and individual consumers, but also across at a community decision-making level. And so obviously addressing the pain points of the community is very important. And from that angle, we work on a very, very comprehensive community model. Looking at resilience, we work on gender parity, we'll work on resilient livelihoods, which are sustainable and based on regenerative principles. And we also work on a very, very successful rural mental health model and disaster control. So these are some of the, this is like a very quick helicopter view of what we do. Back to you, Gaurav.
Thanks, Lina. Thanks for, you know, setting the context and also giving us a very broad perspective on the kind of work Raintree Foundation is doing across a wide range of areas, particularly in the Western Ghats area. Pragya, you know, your foundation, EKSAT, the Earth Foundation, has a multifaceted mission, including tree plantation, combating plastic pollution and fostering reforestation. Can you share specific initiatives or projects that stand out in achieving your goals, and how have they impacted the local communities and environment? Pragya?
Hi, Gaurav. Thank you for having me once again. What we do at Eksaat is that we do a lot of groundwork and on grassroots levels. We partner with a lot of people already doing a lot of good work. We started off in 2020 when the pandemic hit, literally a month before it hit. And all of a sudden, all the plans we had for the foundation had to take a backseat because we had to deal with what was happening at that very moment. And we decided to help out in whatever way we could. And we started, giving out food, which honestly has nothing to do with the environment. But we felt at that moment, helping out in the crisis that we were facing was more important than looking at what we wanted to do as a foundation. We were one of the first people to step on ground and help out in low-income areas, slum areas, with donation of food, ration kits. It was at a time where people, you had been stuck for about 10, 20 days in their homes, and some people hadn't even had food for a week or so, and they were living on basic dal chawal. And stepping out at that that time was had its own difficulties, because a lot of people did not want to step out. There were a lot of fear and a lot of concerns, but at the same time we felt that we want to do this, but we want to do it as much as possible in an eco-friendly manner. So we made sure that everything that we bought it was not packaged food. Everything was, fresh from the vendors. And we looked at, instead of using plastic bags, we used paper bags for our food deliveries and, try to figure out how to have the least amount of carbon impact by sending food in a certain systematic manner. So that's something we did initially for the first 5 months when we started off. And then when the pandemic kind of lifted is when we got back onto the work that we actually wanted to do. Something that is very close to my heart is waste management. I feel a lot of people already do great work when it comes to, forestation and, wildlife rescue. Very few people work with waste. And that is something I have noticed overall, that it's not a area which people kind of prefer looking into. So that has been a struggle, but we have now successfully run a beach cleanup for 123 weeks. It's called the Carter Beach Cleanup. And we have joined hands with a local group of people, of citizens who, started out this movement. And now together we have managed to keep this going and successfully so made an impact not only on ground, but also by getting the right sort of people involved in terms of the government bodies and corporates to come on board and support this movement. We have now gone from the beach into the mangroves, and we have started cleaning up the mangroves. So that is something that we have been doing. Like I said, for me, the forestation bit is more to keep people happy, because I feel it kind of gives people a good, like a feel good kind of a sense. So we do that honestly just cosmetically, because that's what people want. That's not something that I personally feel there is a need for us to, work more upon, because there are already people out there doing great work when it comes to this. So waste management has been something that I've focused on. We have another collaboration going on in the Himalayas. It's called Sustaining Paradise, where we made the first waste collection center in Himachal Pradesh. And it's at a location where there is no way for them to have any waste management facilities. All the waste there used to literally be dumped into the rivers you know, in that area. And we have again successfully now run that for past 3 years, and we have another 10 to 12 centers that have come up. We do this in collaboration with Healing Himalayas, and the success is not only for the fact that it's running, but also the kind of mindset change that has happened in the region, where people are now at source segregating their waste and understanding the kind of impact it has if you don't do it, and how it affects the tourism in the area and the health of the people, health of the land. And that mindset change that has happened is where I feel the success story lies. And of course, again, you're involving the government. They are seeing change and are equally now happy to support and extend the kind of work that we are doing on ground. And now we've just initiated a new project in Bombay itself. It's in an area called Kokri in Wadala, where we have taken up this one community where we are hoping to help them change their mindset towards the waste and now start becoming a low waste area. But the main thought behind this is there is a river that goes, which actually now is kind of become a nala, but was a river that goes straight out into the ocean. So what happens with is that the local people end up throwing all their waste into the nala, and that goes out straight into the ocean. And because of that, there is a big impact and kind of gets linked back to the work that we do on the beach. The beach, again, is just to raise awareness. The idea is that people should come and see what the problem is. But the work we are doing at Kokri is to go to the root cause of things and make an impact and change mindset, help out where government bodies are not able to, you know, create change along with them. We always work with people because, I mean, that's why we called ourselves Ek Saath, because we want to join hands with people. We want people to come together for us to actually see some change. So that's a new project we've just started. We've also started doing cleanups at the Elephanta Caves, which is a UNESCO heritage site. So these are two new projects that we have just started, and we hope that, you know, they will make an impact in the coming future.
Indeed, it will. And I'm sure the kind of work that you are doing will bring in a lot of impact and also encourage others to join similar or start similar initiatives. Lina, considering the underinvestment in climate initiatives within the ecosystem of Indian philanthropy, especially given the critical need, what strategies do you believe can unlock more capital for climate action? How can funders be encouraged and guided to channel their resources effectively to address the pressing challenges posed by climate change in India? Lina?
First thing I think that people with resources and capital to deploy, not just financial capital, but every other kind of capital to deploy towards a root cause is to go back to the root of the causes. Because, this kind of capital doesn't have the pressures that CSR and some other foundations have, because, there are less questions asked, there is a less formally defined mandate in that case. So I think more philanthropists need to go back to the root of the cause when they're looking at climate. And second thing I think I'd like to see philanthropists do is go outside cities to see what happens. Because a whole lot of our ecosystem services, even in cities, we pull from outside our cities. They come from different landscapes other than ours. We pull water, we pull air, we bring soil, we bring sand to build our cities. We bring all sorts of things from outside to give us a fairly, man-made infrastructure, which we think is climate-proof. But fact is, while we are doing climate work in cities, we are actually terribly upsetting the balance somewhere else, from wherever we are drawing these resources. So I think enough philanthropists need to go out to see what the reality is outside the cities. You have to go out of your comfort zone to see where the real India, where the rural India, where agrarians, tribals, mountains, seas, deserts, arid landscapes, water-starved districts, all that we need to see to be able to understand and come to our own conclusions of where are the root causes. The third thing, we're working on a planetary scale. And so defining the problems from that scale, from the planetary angle, from the angle of natural systems is very important, right? And I'd like to touch back on what Pragya said about, waste management and river rejuvenation and so on and so forth. A lot of things we define as climate solutions in terms of man-made problems and societal systems which have gone bad and are upsetting the balance in nature. And then we say we can make them less harmful to the natural balance. And we think we have done a lot. We don't have to now, that net zero is not something which will work anymore. We have to go to net positive. So you have to restore back, not just stop doing harm. And that is something that I think that long longitudinal thought which needs that you will need 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years to make enough mindset changes, lifestyle changes, changes in consumption patterns, for new products to come up, replacing these harmful consumption items that we constantly use. These are all investor decisions in many ways. And whether it's a philanthropic investment or whether it's an impact investing, these are investment decisions as to the time frame of your interventions. And I think if we really, really want to make changes on a planetary scale, if we want to make changes to natural systems, most important, we cannot make change to any one single natural system. Everything in nature is interrelated. And because it is interrelated, which means that when you work on one system, the others still stay untouched. And unless you work on comprehensive solutions across a given landscape, across a contiguous area, it will not really bring back balance. What we need is not solutions to siloed problems. What we need is bringing back some of the balance that we have lost. And I think that is a philanthropic thought which needs to come in. We need very, very patient funding. We need to realize, define success parameters in radically different ways. And learn that intersectional thought, because in nature, everything is in balance. You get something, you give something, right? There are trade-offs and there is a delicate balance being played out minute by minute in nature. And we forget that when things move, something else needs to move after that. And that is what philanthropists need to understand, the dynamic nature of natural systems and how these are constantly evolving programs. Over a 15-year horizon, we have constantly changing metrics for some of the work that we do. When we call it water, we have changing metrics because what we can do in year 1, 2, 3 lays the base for what we can do in year 4, 5, 6 and so on and so forth. It's an increasing ladder approach where one step builds for the next step and it builds for the third step. It really needs a radical shift in the way we think. And I'm not sure in the age of quarterly results and 3-year horizons, and if somebody gives funding for 3 years, it's like, oh, he's a patient funder, or the organization is a long-term funder, but that doesn't work. Our programs are designed to be 15 years long, minimum, with a 5-year pullout. And that's the scale and time frames and the scale that we are working on. And that, I think, thought process needs to be further amplified wherever possible. Back to you, Gaurav.
Very interesting insights, Lina, because you do talk about bringing in a radical shift both in attitude as well as approach in trying to deal with climate change, and also having a very long-term approach and also smashing the silos, if I may say so, in the current thinking and approach, which essentially means that we have to collaborate and collaborate more and more in the years ahead, because, as you mentioned, it's not a QSQT kind of a phenomenon. It's not a quarter, say, quarter kind of a phenomenon. It's a 15-year horizon, at least, that we need to look at, because here we're dealing with climate and the atmosphere. Pragya, how crucial do you think collaboration is in the realm of philanthropy, especially for climate action? Could you share some examples or insights into successful collaborations that have significantly contributed to your mission, Pragya?
You know, Gaurav, I named this foundation Ek Saath for this reason only, that there is not one single person who can, you know, make this change. We have to do it together. It has to be a collaborative effort. And I think something which is very important is that we don't look at it from a lens of what am I gaining out of this, or what is good for my NGO, or, you know, how do I look good with this? That I has to go. There is only a we, and we have collectively created this problem. Whether we are aware of it or not, it is there. It is done by us, and we have to now collectively, you know, go. I don't want to say back, but forward in, you know, removing everything that we have done wrong so far and changing our mindset for the future. We have always collaborated. We have always, you know, helped out people working at a grassroots level, because what we realize with people working at a grassroots level is that they are working extremely hard at, you know, creating that change, but they don't always have the infrastructure when it comes to the kind of paperwork you need when you run an NGO, or, you know, the kind of manpower, accounts, legal. That is something, you know, that infrastructure is not always available for everyone. So that's somewhere where we come in and we support people who are already doing amazing work on ground, and, you know, facilitate them with in areas which they are lacking in. So whether it was our food donation drive, which we started off, we had, you know, a lot of people coming in, joining hands. We worked very closely with the BMC during that time. And that has really helped us out and, you know, got us a lot of goodwill for our other projects in Bombay. The BMC is always on a, you know, back end call, supporting us in whatever way, you know, required. So it has to be a collaborative effort, not only with the people working on ground, but even the government. And like I said, the philanthropist needs to come in with the mindset that this is not something that's going to change overnight, or you cannot look for result in the first 2-3 years. This is a long-term, you know, investment into the future of the next generations. It's like you had an analogy of the tree, that the person who plants a tree knows that it's not going to enjoy the shade of it or the fruit of it. It is for the people that, you know, are coming afterwards. So you have to have a similar mindset that though we are doing this work together today, someone else is going to benefit from it. And I think that is our responsibility, because we have somewhere been the catalyst for the kind of situation we are in today. If we had had the kind of approach our forefathers had towards living, you know, as one with nature, and always being sensitive towards nature, you know, we would not have been where we are today. We would have been in a much more harmonious kind of a world. So I think it is our responsibility to now together come together and create that future. Back to you, Gaurav.
Yeah, thanks, Pragya, because you, I like the way the emphasis that you laid on having a long-term approach. And on that note, Lina and Pragya, to both of you, actually, let's crystal gaze a bit, particularly in 25 years from now, 24 years to be precise. If you look at India at 100 by 2047, when independent India completes 100 years, you know, what are the kind of things that we need to put in together now? Because as Pragya, you know, drew the analogy of planting a tree, the person planting a tree now probably will not enjoy the fruits, but the generations after him or her are going to enjoy. And what are the kind of trees that we need to plant now? What key elements do you believe are essential for philanthropy to effectively navigate the complexities of climate change and drive impactful change as India reaches its centennial year? Lina and Pragya. Lina, first to you, then Pragya.
Right. Okay. I was talking about the balance in nature. So for me, any plantation has to be endemic, right? Not a single species. And there has to be, I think we don't realize that there are parts of nature we don't see, the microbes, you know, the rhizomes and so many things in the soil. The soil is, I think, 70% of the natural balance in any landscape. And we don't see that enough. We just plant trees. We plant 5 kinds, when in nature there could be 200 in a given, you know, square kilometer. And really, you know, greening is a complex initiative. Also in India, we have a tendency to plant trees in the wrong places. Maharashtra, for example, has a tremendous amount of grasslands, which are very, very important microhabitats for the health of our Western Ghats. However, you know, everybody, including the forest department, philanthropists, large greening, you know, organizations, look at a grassland and say, oh, barren, this is fallow land, let's go plant trees. And that's the worst thing you can do, because that landscape is not designed for trees. Okay, there are many, many habitats. There are swamps, there are grasslands, there are riverine systems. Everything cannot be a forest. And again, there are various parts of an ecosystem, and we need to protect those, enhance those, so that they play their own part, because the birds which nest in a grasslands are not going to nest in a forest. And if you don't have those birds and those insects which live out their lives in a grassland, for example, will not have the balance in that valley or in that district or county or whatever it is. So I think we do, you know, we again, this is a very siloed approach about greening, about turning back the clock. It doesn't work that way. We have to take radically different shifts into what we want to do. There is also a rewilding initiative which needs to come back, you know, where we've pushed out all our natural, you know, the wildlife from around our villages and townships. There is an area we are evaluating for our next geography that we want to expand into. And because people have left farming their marginal farms, we have some amount of wildlife coming down from the mountains into closer to human habitation. Now, the question for us is whether we design programs around harmonious existence of that wildlife which has already come back, and teach human communities to live alongside them and you know, use them in wise ways. Maybe there could be ecotourism. Maybe they could play out the part that they used to play out in the natural balance prior to us pushing them back into the mountains. These are all questions of balance. And I don't know whether man, honestly, a human being is equipped enough to be the spokesperson for all species on this earth. So while I understand the need for greening, it seems like a single point agenda to me, unless you have the species and the diversity of species in any given landscape, which bring back the balance between, you know, all systems. I don't think we can talk about greening isolated. It needs to have the birds, the squirrels, the, you know, the mushrooms, the seasonal orchids, and whatever else that might be there, which plays a part in that ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said, because it is the balance and the diversity that makes up for this planet, which needs to be, the balance now needs to be restored in all its glory, and all the pillars will have to stand together for this balance to be restored. Pragya, what do you think we need to do to get our act right by 2047, by the time we turn 100? Pragya?
So I believe that India as a country has you know, always been very close to nature. Our way of operating in the past have always been very sustainable, keeping all, you know, everything in balance. And that's something that is part of our philosophy and the way India has been as a country until, you know, things changed after the Britishers came in, and a lot of mental shifts have happened even lately when a lot comes from, you know, the West, where we want to be like them. And we want to have what they have, not realizing that what we had and what we have is, you know, better than what any other country has when it comes to the kind of diversity we have as a country. We are a country that has, we have beaches, we have mountains, we have desert, we have rainforests. You know, there is so much richness in this country. I somewhere feel like that knowledge that we had, and the balance that we had as a country is somewhere gotten lost. And I think it's very important that we, you know, tap back into that, and we use that to create a future which is more sustainable. I think something that Lina touched upon was ecotourism. As a country, we have so many tourist spots. If we could just, you know, keep in mind the nature aspect of it, I think we as a country can have even more and even better tourism than any country out there, because we have so much to offer as a country. I think it's very important that we, you know, consume and make more locally, and we appreciate what we have, you know, to offer as a country. I strongly feel like, you know, the West has taken so many things from our culture and kind of embedded it into their lifestyle, whether it's yoga or, you know, the way we eat and the way we take care of our body. I feel Ayurveda is something which, you know, the West is also now kind of started to follow. And we somewhere are losing everything because we want to take on what we have seen that the West has. I think as a country, we really in the next 15 to 20, 25 years need to really, you know, remind ourselves of who we are. I think it's very important to be connected to your roots. And unless we do that, we will not be able to grow as a country, because we are somewhere forgetting who we are and what we stand for. We have always been very close to nature, always lived in harmony with wildlife. You know, we've never had these kind of problems. And I think it's very important that we take a step back and look at what we are facing as a country when it comes to the kind of crisis we are in. We are continuously facing, you know, major flooding issues. There are wildfires going on. There is a huge plastic pollution, you know, crisis all over the country. And, you know, our rivers are suffering. Our wetlands are suffering. Like that's something like Lina touched upon. The reason why I personally am not very happy about these tree plantation drives that happens is because when you are doing it, you are not keeping in mind the area you are doing it in and what that area needs. And it's normally people just do it for show. And I think it's very important that we educate ourselves of what is the actual need for the land, and only then should we get involved in that. Otherwise, it's better to just let nature do its job, and nature will find a way. It always does, you know, to create that richness an area need. We just have to stop touching it. It's something I think we all realized even during COVID, that the moment we came right to a standstill, you know, Mother Nature just came out and just started to clean out all the things that, you know, we had kind of messed up. So I think it's very important for the future of our country and the world that we take a learning from our past and our learnings, because India's, you know, always, it's been a country of knowledge. It's been such a rich country in terms of culture and philosophy and mythology. There is so much to learn from that. And if we can, you know, keep all these things in mind and move forward, I think there is a real hope for us and the world itself.
Indeed, of course. And I think it's about time that we take a long, hard look at our own selves and the kind of work that we're doing, and also what is the contribution that we can do to actually restore balance in the environment. Thank you, Lina and Pragya, for these very deep insights and sharing of perspectives in a very insightful conversation for this special podcast episode, Catalyzing Change, the Power of Family Philanthropy as part of Unusual Suspects in collaboration with Giving By. Thank you so much for dropping by to have this conversation with us.
Thank you, and pleasure meeting you on this forum.
Thank you so much, Gaurav.